When Viv asked me to preach on chapter 8, I said, wow, that's meaty. It covers mercy, judgment, forgiveness, freedom from sin, Jesus' identity. Where do I start? So Viv suggested I focus on one bit. But I have to confess, several times I've been tempted to ring her and say, I can't do it. But that's not trusting God, is it? And I've always said I want God to speak through me, which is exactly what Stephen said last week. So, having read chapter 8, it's kind of tricky to talk about one thing, as it's all linked as a whole. The whole chapter is really the Pharisees trying to trip up Jesus and trap him and bring him down. There are three parts to this chapter. Verses 1 to 11 are about the woman caught in adultery. Verses 12 to 58 are a long debate between Jesus and the Pharisees about freedom in sin and his identity. And then the conclusion of verse 59, where Jesus escapes from the Jews when they're trying to stone him. So what I'm going to do is to get you to imagine it's a bit like Google Earth. First, zoom in on the Bible, then zoom in on the book of John, then to chapter 8, and finally on the section, the woman caught in adultery. And I'm also splitting the woman caught in adultery into three aspects for you to think about. Think of this as a verbal thought for the week. At the end, I'm going to ask you questions at the end of the talk, which are controversial, that you may not agree with. But that's fine. The thought for the week, verbal or written, is designed to encourage you to think. If you don't agree with anything I write or anything I say, just take it to God, because agreeing with him is what's important. The first aspect is about the woman herself. The second about the Pharisees, and then the third about us. The account of the woman caught in adultery is actually the gospel in a nutshell, as it covers God's love, forgiveness, mercy and justice, and it demonstrates Jesus' compassion and grace while upholding the principles of righteous judgment. Now it starts off by saying that Jesus had walked up to the Mount of Olives where he'd spent the night, where he would have been praying and listening to his Father. He returned at dawn to resume teaching in the temple. Now I'll read from verses 1 to 11. When Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, at dawn he appeared again. No, that should be after. Anyway, at dawn he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered round him, and he sat down to teach them. Sitting down, by the way, was an act of authority. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "If any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life." But Jesus would have known her heart, and he loved her. He saw the shame, humiliation, and condemnation being piled on her. She would have known what she had done was wrong, and that her very life was in jeopardy. She would most probably be trembling, terrified in fear, the shame making her feel worthless and inadequate. Stoning is a horrible way to die. In 2015, the Taliban stoned a 19-year-old woman to death just for having premarital sex with her fiancé and videoed it. Her fiancé was lashed but not executed. The man, also in chapter 8 account, is nowhere mentioned. The condemnation and shame put on this woman came straight from hell, and the devil does exactly the same to us if we let him. Even though she was guilty, God never condemns, only convicts, and forgives when we are truly sorry. Jesus didn't ignore her sin, he acknowledged it by telling her to sin no more, and he forgave her, free to resume her life, hopefully in a very different way, and believing in Jesus. Jesus took her punishment when he died on the cross, and Jesus takes ours. I have known from experience in my life what shame feels like on a number of occasions. When I was arrested 7 days before my state registered nurse final exams and put in a cell, losing any chance of fulfilling my lifetime goal of being a qualified state registered nurse, I felt shame and fear. I can't tell you my story. I haven't got time to tell you my story today. But I can tell you briefly about my treatment at the hands of a psychiatrist when I was on remand at Puckle Church Remand Centre, now Ashfield Prison, during my drug addiction years awaiting trial. The psychiatrist was a hateful woman who lashed out verbally at me, calling me all sorts of horrendous things, culminating in her accusation that I was nothing but a high-class prostitute. I don't know what she was aiming to achieve, as all she did was further damage an already broken person. The only possible comfort I could have got from that was being called high class. We don't know why this woman was in an adulterous relationship. We know it was sin, no one's disputing that. But had she been forced into a marriage that she didn't want and was very unhappy? Or did her husband abuse her or neglect her? Or was she, as some people think, a woman of ill repute, a sex worker? That doesn't say that anywhere. We have no idea. Some theologians say this account was not in earlier texts, but added much later. But the whole point of the story is to teach us the mercy, love, grace, and forgiveness from God, and to call out hypocrisy. I find myself, knowing the story behind broken people's behaviour, helps me to be much more compassionate and merciful. The woman got law, but no grace. Law highlights sin, and grace offers salvation. And finding the right balance means living in accordance with God's word, motivated by love and gratitude for his grace, rather than striving for righteousness through works. Now we focus on the Pharisees. Just as Jesus knew her heart, he knew theirs. The Pharisees were the religious leaders of the day. They were a truly horrible bunch. They're pompous, arrogant, pious, self-righteous, hypocritical, rigid in their deceived beliefs. Jesus said they were blind guides putting burdens on people. Saul, before his road to Damascus enlightenment, was like them. Jesus called them quite a lot of other things as well, like whitewashed tombs, vipers, snakes, among other things. Why was Jesus so brutally harsh with these religious leaders and blunt, brutally blunt and harsh? Well, believe it or not, It was because he loved them. It was an act of mercy for them, as they were destined for hell unless they took a hard look at themselves and received the truth from Jesus. They didn't just dislike Jesus, they hated him. They were jealous of his popularity and the fact that Jesus was challenging their religious authority. Also, the Pharisees were concerned that Jesus' increasing popularity and claims of being God's son would incite a revolt against Roman rule, leading to the Romans taking away their land and nation. They wanted Jesus out of the way permanently. They had no excuse for their hatred. They had already seen the miracles of Jesus and studied the scriptures concerning him, but their hardened hearts had blinded them to the truth. They had already tried to trick Jesus over taxes to Caesar, so now they try a new tactic with this woman caught in adultery. They didn't care about her at all. They were just using her as a pawn. They led this woman out to stand in front of everybody, caught in the very act of adultery. This alone proves to me it was a setup. Caught in the very act means they didn't just see them kissing in an alleyway somewhere or coming out of each other's houses. They actually saw them having sex. I mean, who does that? They must have been lurking, waiting to pounce. And the Pharisees had already broken their own laws by not bringing the man out too. Leviticus 20:10 says, "If a man commits adultery with another man's wife, with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress are put to death." And Deuteronomy 22:22 says, "If a man is found sleeping with another man's wife, both the man who slept with her and the woman must die. You must purge the evil from Israel." The Pharisees' plan is this. If Jesus had said, "Don't stone her," they would accuse him of violating Moses' law. But if he'd urged them to execute her, they would have reported him to the Romans. The Romans did not permit the Jews to carry out their own executions. If you remember at Jesus' trial, Pilate said, "Take him yourself and judge him by your own law." "But we have no right to execute anyone," they objected. That's John 18:31. They must have later stoned Stephen illegally. They're a corrupt bunch who use the law to suit themselves. And Jesus saying to them, "He who is without sin cast the first stone," shows the genius wisdom of God, and it shuts them up. With that, they all slink away, the oldest first. When I was pondering why the oldest left first, I read what a famous Chinese preacher called Watchman Nee had written. "Guilt is the stain of sins on your conscience. When you're young, your conscience is only stained a little. But as you grow older, these stains accumulate, rather like a window that's never cleaned." So maybe that's why the oldest went first. Also remember, Jesus said, "Anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has committed adultery." Matthew 5:28. Who hasn't looked at someone lustfully at some stage? I haven't always been an ancient grandma, but maybe you're holier than me. Although the Pharisees are deceived and they think they're upholding God's law against adultery, after all, it is the seventh commandment, it doesn't seem to occur to them that their murderous thoughts against Jesus are equally sinful. At the end of the chapter, after the religious leaders and others have finished aggressively debating with Jesus, they try to stone him. So it seems they didn't learn much. Don't feel sorry for them. They had men like Saul and Nicodemus, top men, saw the truth. So God would have given them all opportunities. Now for the third group, which is us. Remember the second commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. Treat others as you wish to be treated. So how do you want to be treated when you sin? People who behave like Pharisees, we often call holier than thou. Pharisaic people tend to talk a lot about how devout and religious they are, but their actions don't quite measure up to their words. We must endeavour not to be like that, but we can all show those behaviours at times. The Pharisees correctly identified her sin according to the Mosaic law, but were devoid of any compassion. It was purely legalistic judgment. So can we or can't we judge? The scripture, Matthew 7:1-2, says, "Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged." But this is often misinterpreted as a call not to judge. You might make a judgment of some sort, and somebody piously says to you, "Oh, we must not judge," and that just shuts you down. But that scripture means that Jesus condemns judgment based on appearances, hypocrisy, condemnation, wealth, or evil motives. But we can make righteous judgments, which involves recognizing our own sin before addressing others. Matthew 7:5 says, "You hypocrite, take the plank out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Then mercy triumphs over judgment." We can judge, but it has to be the right way once the plank is removed from your own eye. We learn compassion and empathy from our life's experiences, but I'm always surprised when people seem to lack basic emotional intelligence. Don't we often jump to judgments, maybe on high-profile criminal cases or politicians, in a way that Jesus would not? Take heart from the woman caught in adultery and remember, nobody is exempt from God's forgiveness, whatever you've done. Remember David and Bathsheba, they committed adultery, and that Jesus came from their line. Right, now for verses 12-58, which is a lengthy debate between Jesus and the Jews, some who claim to believe. I have really struggled to explain this. I thought of reading it straight from the Bible, so I experimented on Moretta. For those who don't know who she is, she's a disabled friend of mine who I visit every week. But as I read it to her, I saw her zone out. So I thought, right, that's a no then. You really need to read these verses for yourself. But I'll put it very simply in my own words, and not as it's exactly written at the Bible, so you need to read it for yourself. Jesus explains he's the light of the world. If they follow him, they won't stumble in the darkness. That's a message to us all. Jesus explains his Father, that's God, is his witness, but they just scoff at him and say, "Well, where is this so-called father of yours?" Jesus explains that if they knew who he was, they would know God. He tells them that they only judge on what they can see and touch. Now, we're a bit like that. He tells them, you can't see beyond the horizon of the mundane. We're also a bit like that sometimes. He tells them straight, you are at a dead end, slaves to sin. All unbelievers are like that. They're my words, not Jesus. Unbelievers are lost. That's why it's so important we talk to them about Jesus. He later explains to them that slaves are not free in a family like a son is, but that the son, meaning himself, can set them free. The truth will set you free. The Jews are now getting really uptight and say to him, well, just who are you anyway? Jesus experiences heavy opposition and he's confident, but he's confident in where he's going and where he has come from. Jesus perseveres with these trapped, deceived Jews who believe they are right and Jesus is a demon-possessed nutcase. Jesus heats up the conversation by saying they are doing what they have learned from their father. They protest that their father is Abraham. But Jesus points out if that was the case, they wouldn't be wanting to kill him. And the fact is that their father is the devil. Jesus also states if they practice what he is telling them, they will never see death. This confirms to the Jews that he's lost the plot and is crazy because all the prophets died. Jesus tells them Abraham looked down in the corridors of history and saw his day, Jesus' day, coming and cheered. The Jews are really angry now and say, you're not even 50 years old and you've seen Abraham, and Abraham saw you. Jesus said, I am who I am. Long before Abraham. That's too much for the Jews, and they pick up stones to throw at him, but he slips away. So what does that tell us? Well, it shows us that we can only be called God's children if we've actually given our lives to Jesus. All humanity are God's creation, but not all are God's children. Only if we've given our lives to Jesus. And that's why Christians are brothers and sisters. It shows the extreme persecution Jesus suffered, and how many Christians in other countries today are facing the same, even to death. I've met many people, well not many, but I've met people who are not interested, but I've never met anyone who hates me, openly hates me, or has wanted to kill me. And it also teaches us Jesus' bravery in his mission to save the lost, and how we must also do our best to preach the gospel and see people as Jesus sees them and be bold. Tell them if you follow Jesus, you will live forever. Forever, life after death. And that concludes chapter 8. So I've got some questions now. I'll read them out, shall I? This is a controversial one. Lucy Letby has been found guilty of murdering 7 babies, but her guilt is now being questioned. Her sentence is what most people agree should happen, which is virtually lock her up and throw away the key. She is 35 and will die in prison. Despite the public outcry over Lucy Letby, we are still paying doctors to dispose of tiny babies. In 2024, it's estimated that there were 300,000 abortions in the UK. Where was the outcry about those? Does this feel like hypocrisy to you? Right, the second question is, reflect on the entire chapter. What is one significant lesson you can apply to your life today? The third question, I feel compassion towards Lucy Letby and have even prayed for her, yet I feel no compassion towards the men accused of raping and abusing the young girls in Rochdale. Am I misguided and why? There are two more questions, but I don't know if we'll have time for them, but I'll read them anyway. Fourth question, how does this chapter illuminate the difference between earthly and heavenly perspectives? And five, what does the truth will set you free actually mean in your life?